almost pick up the an echo between the long path and the short path, and you can actually hear a slight delay where it almost sounds like distortion on top of the signal. And if you depending on how I position the beam, sometimes I can actually hear it almost sounding like the person's repeating themselves after that. I don't know whether you've ever experienced that, Mel. KC2QIQ.
I've experienced on 75 meters the effect from those aurora lights, the aurora borealis, and it does create a wobbling, you know, a funny sound to a lot of the people that you are listening to or talking to, and I've heard that a number of times, it seems to come at certain times of the year. I have heard one guy, he claimed that he called CQ, and he stood by, and he says he heard his call coming back, and he thought that he called QRZ, and that he thought the station that was sending back his call was just such QSB that not all he heard was part of his call. And I've heard a number of these different kinds, but I don't know. I don't know what to say. Okay, let me go back to Dick. We'll stay with what we have now, and maybe we can even discuss this. This is a very interesting subject also of these long delayed echoes. Go ahead, Dick.
Okay, I've got QST in my hand. I'm looking at page 64, the article called Experiment Number 82, Antenna Height, and I'm looking at the various curves. And tell me what I should start looking at, Mel. Go ahead.
One of the controversies is that if you look at, like, curve in Figure 2, C, curve C, of a dipole at half wavelength above ground, that dipole, according to, if you read the article, most likely for DXing, will perform better than the one that is E, one wavelength above ground. Do you believe that, Dick?
Okay. When I look at C, it looks to me like the peak gain is at an elevation angle of 30 degrees, 28 degrees. And if I look at echo, the peak gain looks to me like it's at 15 degrees. And 90-some-odd percent of the time, your lower angle of radiation means you're going to be hitting the ionosphere at a much closer to grazing angle. Therefore, the first hop is going to be much further in miles, and the signal is going to be much stronger. So the lower you can get that first lobe to the ground, the better off you are. I think Charlie and Echo are saying that. So at first, there doesn't seem to be a mystery to me to those particular curves. Back to you, Mel.
The question that was asked to me is, okay, yes, true that you look at like E. E would be a one wavelength, whereas if you look at half wavelength, according to the modeling, even though the main lobe has essentially the same gain, as at a lower angle, 18 degrees, than the half wavelength, short skip high angle, and so on and so forth, but that the as you see, as they've gone up in height, that the number of multi-lobes, and they said that you may be wondering why that if it's raised somewhere that the ideal height would be somewhere between 35 here, it looks at the center feet, that if you look at it, about 35 to 50 feet. The red line shows the difference between that and 50 feet, the halfway, and it shows that somewhere around three-quarters between a one-half wavelength and three-quarters wavelength seems to be ideal for this dipole, and you would think that, definitely as I go up towards the one-and-a-half and two wavelengths, that would be the more or less the peak, Dick, over.
Okay, it's very easy to misinterpret these curves where a person might mentally integrate how much area is in the red curves and make a gain assessment from that. And I'm not sure that's the right way of looking at it. If I look at Alpha, Bravo, and Charlie, and I look near 0 degrees above the horizon in elevation angle, you get an extremely deep dip in the pattern. Very little energy is being put in down there. And as you go to higher and higher altitudes, more and more energy is being put into lower and lower angles. And by the way, all of this jazz is for a horizontally polarized dipole. And I'm still stuck on my hobby horse of saying, why in the world would anybody think that only a horizontal dipole is required? Even if everyone you want to talk to is horizontally polarized. In order for you to talk to anybody beyond your optical horizon, you are, for the most part, on these HF frequencies using an ionospheric bounce. The signal bounces from the ionosphere. I'm using the word bounce in quotes. It's more complicated than a bounce, but consider it a bounce. That ionosphere is a plasma, an ionized chunk of conducting particles of atmosphere. And you mix a plasma with a magnetic field, and you will get a significant amount of Faraday rotation. So to talk about the signal bouncing off the ionosphere is just a small fraction of the story. That signal is twisting in polarization some number of individual complete rotations by the time it makes those multiple bounces to go from you to your buddy in London or your friend in Japan or whatever, or Australia. So what polarization you launch the signal at and what polarization he gets on the other end is a very random, slightly predictable thing. And if you can get a much more desirable elevation pattern by using vertical polarization, stop worrying about the fact that the guy you're talking to is horizontal. 50% of the time when you launch a signal horizontal and it gets to him, it's vertical. So might as well be launching it vertical and get it to him horizontal, so to speak. So what polarization you launch is nowhere near as important as to how low the elevation angle is. And vertical polarization, although mechanically it may be a little bit more difficult in some circumstances, has got a hell of a lot more to offer. And I'm very disappointed that these articles are not saying that. We're stuck in the tradition of everybody using nothing but horizontal dipoles, and they make it sound... The silence is deafening on the subject of giving proper emphasis to a vertically polarized dipole. That's a strongly felt opinion on my part. Maybe you have somewhat similar opinion, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
The controversy really started that, okay, this is the experiment done with just a so-called backyard dipole as part of this, I've looked at this, LNEC Pro, EasyNEC program, and they have this simple thing for working with dipoles, working with wires, basically, that's what they call it. You can turn it this way and that way. But the question was that they applied this over a number of people to Yagis, and they wanted to really know and say, you mean to tell me that my Yagi, my 20-meter Yagi, three-element Yagi on 20 meters, will work excellent at, say, at 50 or 55, 60 feet or whatever, which most of them average people are putting up. And now you're telling us that it does not pay to go much higher. You would think that maybe 150, 200-foot tower with that same Yagi on top of a very tall tower would make it a much better performer. But... It seems like it shows you here that you don't, according to this, higher is not always better. You would raise the dipole one wavelength to higher before it begin rejecting high-angle signals. So, you know, going up another wavelength is a considerable amount of height, and it's, according to this, is it true that it would not really make that much difference for, say, a DX station to hear you, Dick, over?
Would an experiment with a dipole lend itself to a Yagi so easily?
Yeah, there's a degree of comparison between the two, Ed. People are strongly misunderstanding. When you look at Curve Charlie, Curve Charlie looks like it's giving the minimum or a minimum amount of energy straight up. Therefore, by good common sense, you'd say, hey, I'm directing less energy straight up compared to Bravo and Delta, and therefore, I'm going to get a gain. Good-sounding theory ain't true. Good-sounding conservation of energy ain't true. The fact that I'm directing some energy, or a hell of a lot of energy straight up, is true, but not necessarily relevant. On top of that, if I look at the table 1 graphs, table 1 spreadsheet, and I look at the most right-hand column, for various altitudes above the ground, they're talking about the maximum gain in dBi of 7.4, 5.6, 7.4, 7.3, and so on. A naive person looking at those curves will say, gee, the real low one is 7.4, and at eighth wave above ground, and then quarter wave above ground, I drop down to 5.6. And that is 1.8 dB less gain. A naive person will say, whoa, I don't want to lose 1.8 dB of gain. A more intelligent person will say, the angle at which I launch that signal and the way it bounces off the ionosphere can make easily a 20 decibel difference in signal strength that gets to the other end. If I'm getting a more desirable angle of radiation, even if I'm getting 1.8 dB of loss, but I'm picking up 20 dB due to the bounce phenomena, I'm way ahead of the game. What Mother Nature does with her ionosphere and polarization can easily make 20 and 30 decibels of increase and decrease of signal strength. If you carefully watch your S meter, and if it's well calibrated in decibels, and you look at what happens during a QSB fade, you get tremendous numbers of dBs of up and down. Mother Nature can do that. And to talk about a dB, 1.8 dB of difference on the way I launch the signal is penny-wise, pound-foolish. It's putting the emphasis on the wrong syllable. That's not where it's happening. That's part of what I see going on here. And to emphasize all of these patterns with purely horizontal dipole and not even discuss the huge improvement you get with vertical polarization, to me, is a bit of a crime. Let me turn it over to Ed and see if he's got some opinions on any of this. WB2EAV, K2RIW.
I pretty much agree with you, Dick, but I don't know if you're going to get too much of an audience if you're pushing for vertical polarization. Well, you definitely have some points. But what I do notice is, like you say, is what really counts is the angle towards the ionosphere, which is probably not a fixed angle, and probably at different times the ideal angle varies. So all of this stuff is wonderful, but I'm not sure how useful it is. And remember, this is probably modeled based on flat, highly conductive terrain without too many trees and the like. You take a more realistic installation with trees, hills, telephone poles, etc., it really gets mushy.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said, Ed. And yes, the ideal angle of launching the signal from day to day changes slightly. However, if you study the statistics, I think you'll discover that 90% of the time, the lower the angle that you launch, the better. On the assumption you don't have a great big hill in front of you, or the Empire State Building in front of you, or a stand of trees that are 80 foot high and they got wet leaves on them, and it's only 20 feet away from your antenna. With the exception of some really weird things like that, the lower the angle that you truly launch that signal and give it out to the horizon, your local horizon, the better, with rare exception. Lower the angle is always better. And that angle that you launch it and the way it bounces off the horizon can easily make a 20 decibel difference in signal strength on the S meter of the guy on the other side, the guy that you're sending the signal to. And the nice thing about vertical polarization with grazing angles on the horizon is that it doesn't give you this cancellation on the horizon. Horizontal polarization always gives you a cancellation 0 degrees above the horizon. That's a given, as long as you've got conductive ground. And vertical polarization gives you a near maximum signal on the horizon, and a whole lot of angles near that. So Mel has got real hard evidence on that vertical piece of wire that's in the evergreen tree out in front of his house. That signal sings. That antenna sings. That's a rock crusher. And the fact that none of the books on rudimentary antennas for beginning amateurs tells you about off-center feeding of a dipole or vertical polarized dipoles is a bit of a crime. That's a strongly felt opinion, as you can tell. Back to you, Mel. But I'll bet you, whenever you compare that vertically polarized antenna in your front yard to any of the horizontal antennas you've ever used, I bet you it's very hard to beat that antenna. That's what I think you've been telling me. K2KEY, K2LIW.
That's true. Its performance is just outstanding. In fact, I got accused a couple of times of just pulling people's legs that I am not actually working a station that I'm coming back to because they don't hear that station. Guy called me on the phone, and he says to me, he says, "You're really telling me that you're hearing so-and-so, the particular station at the time?" And I says, "Yeah, I just worked him." In fact, I said, "He's still on. He's calling QRZ and all." I said, "In fact, I says, let me put the telephone near the speaker. I'm sure you'll be able to hear him." He says, "Must be my this new rig I bought, and I don't hear this." And he went into a tirade. I says, "It's not your receiver. I don't think so." I says, "What I believe it is your antenna." And he says, "What are you talking about?" He says, "I've got this, whatever, and all." But I says, "Well, let me tell you." And when I told him what I'm running, he says, "It's impossible, basically. Because it's a hard sell that you're going to tell somebody that this antenna system that costs them, I don't know, enough maybe to buy a new compact car, and it's not going to perform as well as a wire that's a couple dollars worth of wire." Hot sell, Dick.
WB2EA.
Yeah, we're fighting decades of tradition. Go ahead, Ed.
This is the time to point out I usually use $10 antennas, and if anybody in Ohio comes back to me, I'm thrilled.
Yes, that's part of the magic of radio and part of the magic of ham radio, that if you're crafty enough, very inexpensive stuff that you've got around or in your local hardware store, if you know what you're doing, can give you very high performance on HF, VHF, microwave, whatever. That three-quarter inch water pipe that's in the Home Depot hardware department is a beautiful, extremely high performance piece of waveguide at 10 gigahertz. Better than the mil-spec silver-plated WR90 waveguide that you can buy from the Andrew company. Better in insertion loss. And the Andrew stuff is $500 or 100 feet or whatever, and the Home Depot stuff is a few percent of that price. And easy to put together with a blowtorch and some solder and right-angle plumbing connectors and whatever. So that's the magic of ham radio. You learn enough about the art and science and study the subject and discuss it with your buddies, and sometimes some very inexpensive equipment can do very high performance. Mel's couple of dollars worth of wire, vertically polarized in the tree, hidden in the tree in the front of his house, might very well top by a long shot the $1,000 antenna that's in your backyard. $1,000 for the antenna sitting on $5,000 a tower, if you know what I mean. A horizontally polarized Yagi might not have anywhere near the performance 75% of the time with particular band conditions. None of these books discuss a vertically polarized half-wave dipole. Lots and lots of books will tell you about a quarter-wave ground plane with a zillion ground plane radials. All of those radials are not required, and the performance improves tremendously when you take that $400 ground plane radio with all those doodads on it and all those ground plane radials, and you substitute it with a simple wire piece of half-wave dipole strung in the tree in the backyard. You might end up 6 dB stronger. 6 dB stronger and $400 cheaper. K2KEY, K2RIW.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
The time is 11:20 p.m. Good evening, W2VL repeater system.
Yeah, just a small comment that I have an antenna system where I can actually control, you know, horizontal, vertical. I can even go in between, and mainly the antenna set up for between, you know, 10 and 20 meters, where most of the activity lately I've been using is on 20. And what I notice is that when I go into the vertical polarization, when I rotate the antenna into vertical and I spin it around, I do pick up a lot more ground noise, a lot more hiss in the background. The S level comes up a lot higher, and it's harder to hear the stations. And when I bring the antenna into the horizontal position, I can hear the stations pick up a lot better, with the exception of mobile stations. You know, a lot of times, like if I'm talking to somebody in California in a mobile, or in North Carolina, and I spin the antenna to vertical, then generally I can talk to the mobiles a little bit better, or people with vertical antennas. So it does seem to, you know, follow that, you know, people that are on horizontal, I seem to get better contacts with on horizontal, and people that are vertically polarized, I tend to get better when I go vertical. It's just nice, I guess, to have the availability of you know, being able to do both. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Let me ask you a couple of questions on this one, Glenn. It is my belief that I set up a 20-meter, three-element, four-element Yagi on a reasonable altitude of tower and mount it in such a way that I can rotate the boom in polarization, not in elevation. I can spin the mast in azimuth, always have the antenna aimed at the horizon, but I can rotate the boom in elevation. And if I mounted that 20-meter beam right at the top of the tower, I can't go pure vertical, otherwise the elements are touching the tower. But if I go, 60 degrees from horizontal, 30 degrees from pure vertical, I think I could pick up a hell of a lot of performance from time to time. Yes, vertical polarization is a little bit more sensitive, quite a bit more sensitive, to local power line noise, which is more vertically polarized than horizontal for a bunch of complicated reasons. However, power line noise has a very specific spike to it every time it goes into its high voltage arcing phenomena. If you've got a noisy insulator on your LIPA or Con Ed powering in your neighborhood, if you've got the right kind of a noise blanker, quite a percentage of that can be removed. So I'm wondering how close you get to vertical, how you mechanically have mounted the antenna so you can do that, and how much faith you have in the particular noise blanker you're using, because there are noise blankers and there are noise blankers. The Drake R4C receiver has a noise blanker that is very difficult to improve on. I think the Kenwood 850, I think, came close. KC2QIQ for some comments on all of the above, K2LIW.
Oh, sure. The antenna, the radio that I use on sideband most of the time is the TS940S, and it has two noise blankers with variable noise level and a very, very useful notch filter and SSB slope tuning. So I can really trim it in pretty nice and, you know, get some very, very nice performance out of the receiver, and it's pretty exceptional. But I guess what I was trying to point out is that the type of noise is not the, you know, that spiking noise that you were explaining before, that normally I would hear like on 40 and 80 meters, you know, especially during the summertime, you know, with a lot of, you know, lightning in the background, the popping and the snapping. I don't really get that. It's actually, if I'm just watching my S meter and I go from horizontal to vertical, if I'm hearing a good DX station in Europe and I go to the vertical position, a lot of times what will happen is the station starts fading out and the background hiss and the S level comes up. And then as I rotate it back towards horizontal, the background S noise goes down and the quality of the signal comes up. And I said, really the only exception that I've noticed is when, you know, somebody's on like a Cushcraft vertical or one of those high tower antennas, or, you know, those kinds of antennas that are all vertically mounted, or the mobiles. And then definitely when I go into the vertical position, then they come way booming well above the S level. And even with DXing, I've noticed even without, in other words, the stations that I normally get the best are people with very, very high gain horizontals, like the step IR or the log periodics in the horizontal position. The people I usually hear the best in the vertical position are, you know, the vertically mounted, like those high tower antennas, which are very effective, the K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
What antenna, how many elements, on what band are you able to continuously rotate in polarization, or do you do a complete flip over from horizontal to vertical by going from antenna A to antenna B? Mechanically describe how you go, how you rotate to vertical polarization. Glenn, go ahead.
Okay, the antenna that I'm using is a Cushcraft MA5B. It's a kind of like a compacted beam that covers pretty much everything from 10 to 20 meters. Majority of the real DXing that I do with the antenna is on 20. 10 is kind of, you know, off and on, and mostly local performance lately. 15 pops in and out occasionally, so I'll play around there. But 20 is really where I've used it the most. And here again, I have a rotator on the boom of the antenna itself. I replaced the clamp that was in the middle, the fixed clamp, and replaced it with a azimuth rotator, so I can swing it, you know, 0 to 180 in any in either direction, left or right. So 0 on the azimuth rotator, where the 90-degree point is right in the center, and that's when it's horizontal. So I can either go from 90 to 0 or from 90 to 180 and flip it all the way around. So I have full adjust, you know, adjustment there. And I also use, you know, a regular rotator to go north, south, east, and west. So I've got the two rotators, and I can, you know, it gives me a lot of flexibility to how I can position the antenna.
Okay. The elements of this normally horizontally polarized antenna, when you rotate it to what you call 0 or 180, which is purely vertical, how do the elements of the antenna miss the tower? I guess some of the elements are in front of the tower, and some of the elements are behind the tower? Or how did you mount the antenna in such a way that mechanically the tower and support structure is not in the way? Back to you, Glenn.
Well, the way the MA5B is constructed, it's got a about an 8-foot boom on it, and the two of the elements are in front of the in front of the rotators, and the reflecting element is in the rear. So it's basically a two-element beam. The way that it's set up, and the middle bands, like, you know, 12 and 17, are really just a rotatable dipole, and so they sit those the directing element or the driven element is basically the is in front of the rotator, and then what's in back of the rotator is the reflecting element, and of course the other rotating dipole is in front of the rotator. Back to you, there.
When the antenna is purely vertical, what is the spacing between the nearest vertical element of the antenna and the support structure of your mast and tower? What's that spacing when you're purely vertical? Glenn, go ahead.
That spacing is, I don't know, probably 20 inches or so from that mast. But it doesn't seem to have much of an effect. And the other thing with that one, too, is the... It's offset a bit also, so in other words, it's not only 18 inches, it's probably about 4 inches off to one side, because the that azimuth rotator is actually holds it off the boom slightly about 4 inches off from the center line of the 2-inch mast.
Okay, so I think you're saying your antenna itself, when you're on 20 meters, the nearest 20-meter element to the support mast and or tower is a significant enough distance that the element experiences very little detuning. Now, when you do rotate to vertical, when you listen to the sound of the noise that you get out of the receiver, on the average day, what percentage of it is power line static, and what percentage of it do you think is just the noise coming in over the horizon through the ionospheric reflection from areas of the world that you're listening to that probably have thunderstorms and whatever going on? It's quite possible that that noise you're hearing is telling you that that particular part of the world is giving you a strong signal at this time. And if there was somebody sending you back a real radio signal as opposed to Mother Nature's noise, that it would be a gangbuster signal, somewhat like what you get from the mobiles you talk to in California. Back to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
I would say, Dick, that that last statement you made is really sends it home. That basically, when somebody's on vertical polarization, and I'm on vertical polarization, wow, even though it's just a single, in most cases, they're just basically coming back on a not a high-gain antenna. It's just basically a, you know, a vertically mounted pole as opposed to a beam with a lot of elements on it. I get a very, very strong signal. Front repeater,
timeout.
you timed out the machine. That's the first time we've had a timeout on this machine, on the 8-5. So you're hearing background noise, vertically polarization, with strong signals from mobiles in, say, California, when you're purely vertically polarized. And it's not the popping sound you get from a local power line breakdown. It's real Mother Nature atmosphere.
Repeater, timeout.
It's real atmospheric noise like you would hear when that portion of the world has Mother Nature's noise. And I think you said it's louder in the daytime when you've got D-layer absorption. So looking at just S-meter and noise level is not the whole story, is the impression I'm getting, Glenn. Signal-to-noise ratio is what is where it's at. Who cares if you get 2 S units of more noise, and if you get 3 S units of more signal? You're ahead of the game with the vertical. I am curious, what percentage of the time are you running vertical polarization versus horizontal polarization, daytime versus nighttime, on 20 meters? Where do you favor, Glenn? Go ahead.
Well, it seems like most of the time when 20 seems where I hear the most activity, is usually during the, like on a Saturday afternoon or a Sunday afternoon. That's when I usually get most of my DXing in, and that's where things are usually most favorable. And the funny part is, yes, when I'm talking to, you know, base mounted verticals, you know, on those stations in vertical, I definitely hear them much stronger. And, you know, they'll tell me, oh, I'm using a vertical antenna, you know, like an R7000 or something like that, or, you know, a high tower, high gain. They'll usually tell me what is, or, you know, they'll say they're mobile. And I can usually tell the difference right away by going vertical. But the bad news is, if you're trying to get the real DX guys, a lot of them are all on the horizontal polarization, you know, using this the step IRs, the big Yagis, and it's hard to hear them in vertical because of all the noise. But the minute I flip it down onto the horizontal side, wow, then I get all those guys in. And sometimes if you try to run a net, you know, across a couple of states, or, you know, you get a couple of guys from Europe in, and I'm listening to a few guys around the back. I try to sometimes sneak it in between, you know, between, you know, horizontal and vertical, somewhere in between, like a, almost like a 45 degree position, and usually I can pick up a little bit of everything. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Does it take you about 90 seconds, minute and a half? No. Does it take you, let me think now, 15 seconds. Does it take you about 15 seconds to rotate from horizontal to vertical, Glenn?
Yeah, give or take. You know, it's usually the, most of the time when I'm listening, you know, I'm kind of like tuning the antenna around, just kind of like sniffing around, pointing it in a direction, and then just check the polarization, you know, twist it up and down a little bit to see where I get the best performance. But yeah, about 15 seconds sounds about right for just doing the going from horizontal to vertical.
What's the brand name of your polarization rotating rotator, brand name and model number? What's the biggest boom diameter it'll tolerate? Will it tolerate a 2.5-inch diameter boom? Go ahead.
Okay, the rotator, it's called a Kepro, and it's a KR500, and the nice little rotator. And it'll handle up to a 1.5-inch boom. That's why the MA5B is about as big an antenna as, that I can put on it. And the mast that it can that the rotator will bolt to is certainly at least a 2.5. You can go to a nice sized mast. I've got it clamped around a 2-inch mast going into the tail twister rotator, and the boom is 1.5, and that's just about the max you can get through the center of that.
Okay, but still that's better than some of the Alliance rotators, which I think don't go beyond 1.25-inch mast, and they're nowhere near as rugged. You would consider this a fairly rugged rotator, like the ones that guys use for satellite work?
Yeah, absolutely. That's who I actually got it from, somebody was doing that. And initially, this wasn't the intention. I was going to go with stacked beams, and I was doing something different back in 2007. So I've had this up there about 2 years now, and really haven't had to. Everything's kind of sealed. It's got nice little roller bearings inside of it, where it clamps around the boom and everything. So it seems pretty robust. And this antenna isn't that huge, you know, for a you know, for a 10 through 20 meter antenna. It seems to handle just fine.
Roughly how expensive is that rotator? And is it rated for a maximum number of pounds that it can handle or the maximum amount of wind loading?
Yeah, I'm sure it is, Dick. I paid used about $250 for it. It's very, it looks like a copy of one that was made by Yaesu at one time. Yaesu has something that basically where they integrated their azimuth rotator in with their regular north-south-east-west rotator. So it looks almost identical to that. As a matter of fact, Kepro, who makes this, and must have had something to do with the licensing agreements with Yaesu, because it's a dead ringer for it. And the wind loading is, you know, typically what you could probably stack maybe like four Yagis, four large 2-meter Yagis on, so to give you a rough idea of, you know, what it's capable of. I think in the pictures they show you, you know, stacking four 2-meter Yagis.
The Yaesu is a G5600B and it's still available. And what's the maximum diameter of mast it'll tolerate, Eric, go ahead.
I think it's 2-inch. You know, don't quote me on it. I'm not absolutely sure, but it's been on my roof for a lot of years, and it holds a 2-meter and a 440 and a 1.2 separated by a fiberglass boom. And, of course, all three antennas are circularly polarized, or I can do it as left hand or right hand or individually horizontal and vertical.
Boy, do you have adaptability. Now, the one thing that you've been saying, Glenn, that's a little bit funny sounding to me, is that when you're talking to mobile guys, horizontal guys, base station guys, vertical guys in California, there's at least one, if not two, bounces off the ionosphere to get you to California. And you seem to be saying that you must be horizontal when you talk to the horizontal people, you must be vertical when you talk to the vertical people. You seem to be saying there's a 99% correlation between what polarization they're using and what polarization you're using. And if that's so, then something about the path between New York and California creates high correlation in polarization, as if there is no Faraday rotation off the ionosphere. And if that's really true, then it's knocking a hole in what I've been saying along those lines for some time. I'm saying the ionosphere is a plasma with a magnetic field, and it's going to give you rotation. Now, maybe because you're going exactly east-west, directly at right angles to the magnetic field, maybe in that particular circumstance, the polarization is not being rotated. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Well, here again, that's been my experience, and with the particular antenna setup that I have, you know, when I'm, you know, when I want to do real DXing, to most of the big dogs out there, they're usually using, you know, Yagis and log periodics and the step IRs. As a matter of fact, usually the guys that come in with the biggest signals, usually ones with step IRs and the log periodics. And you know, when I'm going to Europe, and you know, I had a contact with Israel around 3 o'clock this afternoon. And you know, making those contacts, and typically they're, you know, I get them on the, they're coming in, I get the best reception from them usually in the horizontal position, and usually the guys that I'm getting, you know, vertical are much closer. You know, California is quite a bit closer than, to at least it seems anyway, than Europe, or but then again it's true of the Midwest also, in which Midwest, North Carolina, New Hampshire, when I hear mobiles, a lot of times going up and down 95 or going up Northway and things like that, I can usually talk to them better in vertical polarization, even on, you know, on 20 meters. It is kind of interesting. And, you know, if I move it down to the horizontal, I usually can hear them, but it gets, you know, a lot more choppy, and, you know, I definitely hear them better when I'm in vertical. Vertical to vertical and horizontal to horizontal. It's just, that's the way it's working out. Here again, the only other thing I can say is maybe my antenna isn't high enough to really get the effect that you're really talking about. I mean, I'm right here at sea level, and the top of my antenna is just barely 40 feet, you know, so the boom is at 40 feet, so maybe that's just not high enough. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
40 feet strikes me as a good altitude on 20 meters. That's a good fraction of a wavelength. have you ever run into the cross-polarization optimization? In other words, not looking at signal-to-noise ratio, only looking at signal strength. Have you ever found a situation where you're horizontal and he's vertical? Or he's horizontal and you're vertical when you get the strongest signal? Have you ever seen cross-polarization peaking? Back to you, Glenn.
The time is 11:41 p.m. This is the WQVL repeater.
I would say that I have, Dick, but it was a very strange circumstance. A neighbor in my backyard had a tree that was maybe about 25 feet away from my antenna. And I would notice that whenever I would go, like normally to Europe, I'm usually pointing my beam north of east. And a couple times I would get stations, you know, further south, you know, much further down into the Middle Eastern area and that area of the world. And I would definitely go more east to southeast to get the better signal from them. And I found that a couple of times when that tree was there, I had to kind of like go to like this halfway in between kind of position to get a better signal strength out of them. But since that tree blew down in a storm about a year and a half ago, I don't have that problem anymore. K4IW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, so the tree was giving you grief, but now that the tree is gone and you're more pure in your vertical capability and all that RF energy you sent in that tree, that's what killed it. That's a joke. You're still saying, though, that cross-polarization peaking seems to be rare, is your experience. In other words, on very few occasions, have you been horizontal, he's vertical, or he's horizontal and you're vertical? How about you, Glenn?
I would say that that's somewhat accurate, but keep in mind, too, the sunspot activity and the amount of... I would imagine that when the sunspot cycle picks up again and that air really starts getting ionized, then I'm going to probably wind up finding a lot more of what you're talking about, finding in-between areas, because how well-defined those signals are going to come dropping in is going to be a lot different than now where everything's nice and quiet out there.
Okay, more research to follow. Looks like we don't have the whole answer here yet, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, let me tell you. I listen to this very carefully. The stations that I have worked, the DX stations, I have worked on 20 meters. Mostly all were big, a lot of them, the ones, the big signals on 20, are big horizontal arrays with towers that, oh my God, 175, 200 feet. I guess I told you about a few of them. You've looked at them on the web. And now, going over, now something different changes when we get to like 30 meters. And here where I say, because of my experiment on 30 and 40. If you remember, on 30 meters, I connected that wire, connected to the tree. And if you remember the thing I did when you started saying about changing the angle, you remember the experiment I did with the pulley, pulling the antenna up and letting it down, pulling it from the, in other words, it could lay vertical, of course, without pulling on a cord. And then as I pulled it up, I began to pull the antenna from a vertical position towards the horizontal, and I found a happy medium between them, Dick. But it seems that is more prevalent as you get, lower in frequency, over.
Now, when you were using that pulley system to change the antenna from horizontal to vertical, you're changing the polarization, you're changing the altitude above ground in wavelength of the phase center of the antenna, which is also changing the low angle of radiation toward the horizon. A bunch of things are changing at once. That makes judging which is better is a little bit more difficult. And the antenna that you're pulling up and down, you probably said it, but I missed it. Which antenna was that, Mel? Go ahead.
30-meter antenna. No, the feed point is, in other words, the one side of the wire stays put. It was connected to that high up on the tree. So the feed point, more or less, did not really rise or fall very much. What I was doing when I was pulling the other end of it, in other words, the other end of the antenna, with the pulley and the cords. In other words, I was causing this antenna to become sort of, well, I wouldn't say staying, you know, in a stiff, straight line because the wire is flexible. So as I began to pull the pulley with the cord on it, you know, the bottom would start to come up first. So it looked like a concave antenna, more or less, Dick. So it makes that angle with the ground, the bottom was making an angle of the ground with the ground of like, I don't remember, 20 degrees or something like that, 22 degrees, 25 degrees, whatever it was. In other words, I'm pulling it up gradually until it gets to a certain point before it starts to actually raise the feed point over.
Okay, the antenna itself, you're pulling up with pulleys, and the pulleys were operating from where to where? One suggestion would be the pulley is operating from the peak of the tree to the top of the antenna, and you're lengthening or shortening that distance. Or another way you could be using the pulleys is you're pulling the bottom of the antenna further closer to the tree or further away from the tree, making it kind of a sloper. Where was the pulley pulling from and to on that antenna, Mel? Go ahead.
Exactly. In other words, I had the one side of the antenna fixed to the tree. Then I had another support a distance away. That's where the pulley was on. And the cord just went around that pulley to the bottom of the antenna, which had a weight. I had fishing weight, one of lead weight, so that if I let the cord out, the antenna hung perfectly, almost perfectly vertical from the, you know, the support on the tree. So as I began to pull it, the support, you know, the wire began to curve slowly but surely, and if I kept pulling it, you know, I basically would wind up basically with the antenna back to horizontal. So in other words, I wasn't really a pure sloper, that because, you know, that would mean a straight pull from the tree at a specified angle. This was like a, sort of like a concave. In other words, you know, it was making a curve because it was being gently pulled up, Dick. When I went to the pure horizontal, it did not perform as well as somewhere in between. In other words, I was taking signals in between, dropping it vertical and pulling it somewhere up towards the horizontal, over.
Interesting. When the pulley was allowed to be as loose as possible and the antenna as close to vertical as possible, the bottom of the antenna on that band was how far above ground? It's test question number one. Question number two, the pulley is pulling the bottom of the antenna out and up, if the top of the antenna is mounted at, let's say, the 50-foot level of the tree, was that pulley pulling the bottom of the antenna toward another support that was also 50 feet above the ground? So were you pulling from a point that's 50 feet above the ground? No. And how far was the bottom of the antenna from the ground when you're purely vertical? Back to you, Mel.
That's what I was doing. In other words, I wanted to see, would the antenna be a better antenna if it was hanging vertical with the bottom almost touching the ground, you know, maybe a foot above the ground when it's let out all the way? Or would the antenna work better as I pulled it up somewhere and it became a classic dipole? That was my experiment. What happened? And I was just letting it out, pulling it up, back and forth and all, and for some reason, I found a magic angle, and how am I going to describe it? It's somewhere pulled away from the vertical of the tree, of course, and it's the bottom sort of curves back up at with an angle of, with the ground that's almost, not parallel to the ground, I don't know, a few degrees. It actually, the distance above ground when I had it at the optimum was about maybe 15 feet above ground, Dick. Over.
Sounds like the antenna was approaching a parabolic shape, but not quite. It's partially a sloper. So there's some horizontal portion, some vertical portion. I think you're feeding it in the center. And as you pull on that pulley, I presume the feed point starts backing away from the tree somewhat. Is that true, Mel?
Yeah, even though it's not up against the stalk of the tree, you know, the center of the tree, it's out. In other words, I have it tied to a branch that juts out a number of feet so that it didn't have to lay up against the main center of, this is a pine tree, so the center of a pine tree is a nice straight stalk. It's almost beautifully, vertical, straight up about now, close to 70 feet now. So it's like, a very good mast. And so it was mounted to a branch all the way up there that's away from, I moved it away from the actual center of the tree. So when I'm pulling, yes, it looks like, if you looked at it as a side wood, it looked like a parabolic of some sort, Dick. But for some reason, it's a magic number that I happened to hit over.
W2VL repeater system. The time is 11:51 p.m.
The dipole, I think, is being fed in the center. Is the center being constrained, supported? As you pull on the pulley, is the center of the dipole, the feed point, almost fixed in position? Or is it able to pull itself away from the tree and the transmission line allows it to extend? How does that work, Mel? Go ahead.
Exactly. In other words, right now, the way it's set up right now, if you look at it, it's not the piece that comes down where it's supported onto the top of the tree. It's no longer hanging vertical no more. It's sort of tilted out. The bottom is sort of curved out. And what I did, as I said, I listened to signals with pulling it up and down at that time. I spent hours with it. I spent the weekend really playing around with it on 30 meters when we had some decent conditions. And I was just watching. I said, maybe it's the time of day. We'll try it later. We'll try it earlier. We did this. I did that. And for some reason, it kept coming back to this. That I actually to watch the peak, how I was not watching an S meter. I was using a scope on it. I took an old 5-meg scope I had, pulled out the original 5-inch CRT, put in a long resistance, a P7 phosphorus, so I could just look at the audio peaks, in other words, so I could see the persistence, actually watching it so I could get actually see definite signal peaks stick over.
Yeah, I've sometimes gotten that kind of a function by disabling the AGC of the receiver, cranking down the RF gain control, and now as the signal gets stronger and weaker, you hear a definite difference in what comes out of the loudspeaker or earphones. When you disable the AGC and crank the RF gain control, you immediately can tell the difference between a strong and a weak sideband signal. Under normal circumstances, your automatic gain control takes that out and everything sounds the same, unless you're carefully watching the S-meter. A human hearing system listening to a sideband signal can much more quickly judge strong versus weak sideband than a dancing signal strength meter when the guy is talking and you're trying to figure out are the peaks as high. It's much more difficult as I see it. Interesting experiment. So I have the impression that the center of your dipole and the feed line going to it, the transmission line, is not tied to a branch. It's not constrained. As you pull on the pulley, the feed point is able to extend itself out. The loop in the transmission line is not constraining it. It just unloops itself, so to speak, a U-shape in the transmission line. And so the center gets pulled away from the tree, just like the rest of the antenna, when you pull on the dipole. Have I got that approximately correct, Mel? Go ahead. And we're getting short on time, by the way. KQLIW.
Exactly. In other words, I got another tree. It's, the pine tree that stands in the garden by the house, and then out in the front of the house off the sidewalk is another tree. It's a maple tree. So I just had a hook on that thing, and that's it. That was my best way of doing it, because that exactly gives me a nice cord when it was being pulled from that point straight to the Radio Shack. I could, right through the window of the Radio Shack. So it made an excellent way of controlling it, going up and down and all, and watching that scope and everything. And what I was able, basically, on 30 meters, there's no sideband, it's all CW, that band. But there are a couple of commercial radio teletype stations that operate. Now, one operates out of the Middle East, and another one operates out of Europe. I know there's several on there. I know basically where they are. and I was watching it. I was using those teletype signals, basically great indicator, and I could see that I'm moving this antenna up and down. I'm seeing, you know, changes, real changes, definite changes in that in the peaks of those signals. But I found one happy medium. Seems like it fixed it all. In other words, this time one size did fit all. When I got this antenna curved a certain way, Dick, and it's amazing, because I still got it up that way. What I did, however, I mean, I dropped. It's no longer connected to the front, to the, in other words, it's still connected to this pine tree, but I moved it over to the side, because to make that curve and everything like that, it had to hang down to over the sidewalk too low. So I made it go over the other side, you know, where up by my house, on the side of the house, that direction, where I could fix it in that position and leave it over.
Have you ever looked at the standing wave ratio of the antenna as you were operating those pulleys? In the ideal world, the S meter, the standing wave ratio would never go more than, you know, 1.3 to 1.5 type stuff. I wonder if you had a chance to see that, Mel. Go ahead.
Being that, you know, 30 meters is a small band, and so I after I looked at it, you know, before when I started, no, when I used it for transmitting, now the SWR has always stayed basically just about 1.5. There's no problem on that band, because you're only operating a 50 kilohertz total width, really, on that band, because nobody really operates more than, in fact, I seldom see anybody over 10.150. I don't think there's any action there, you know, because I don't think there's no authorization for it. So everybody stays more or less towards the 10.100. The fact of 10.100 to about 10.130 is basically just about all the activity in the band. Seldom hear anyone even over that point. So there's no problem with SWR and getting an antenna, you know, trimmed easily, Dick, over.
Beautiful. I think we're running out of time, Mel. What you guys have been listening to is TechNet number 1267. Of the group of TechNets that began in September of 1982, 27 years ago. On the assumption that Mel and I stay healthy, we'll be back again next week. Be kind to each other. Bye-bye, you all. 73 for now. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. As I said, there's a lot to antennas, a lot of story, and I'm telling you that unless you really, you can, this computer modeling is wonderful, but sometimes it's got to go out there and do the field work, really, and see for yourself, and sometimes you come up with ideas, things that are so out of left field, you think, how could it be? But it does happen. So Mother Nature, I think, has got some secrets still up her sleeve with antennas. I don't think we still know the whole story. I don't think we've got the whole story yet. But we're working on it. Okay, Dick. Everybody, thank you. Take care. Catch you next week. This is K2KEY. Good night, all.
Good night, Mrs. Calabash, wherever you are.
Dick, are you and Mel coming out to the Limark Hamfest next week, K2YO?
Yeah, I should have mentioned the fact that there is a Hamfest next week at the Levittown Hall. Medium good chance. Back to you, Barry.
The W2VL repeater.
Hey, well, always a pleasure seeing you guys. I hope you make it to K2YO.
KF7, FCV monitoring.
Disconnected. Connected. Disconnected.
Hey, DJ.
Reflector 9126.